Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome. I'm Sarah Chessis, and I'm very honored to be speaking here tonight for Chevrat Nashim on the topic of the mikvah. So I spent 2 years studying at Mishmat in Israel to become a Yotze Halacha, which is an advisor for women in Jewish law relating to mikvah. And I am working on putting together a position for the Greater Boston community in Sharon and in Brookline as a Yotze Halacha to be the resource for women in the community. That's for another time, but I couldn't help but share that tonight. And this evening, I'm very thankful to the leadership of Chevrat Nashim in this room for inviting me to speak here tonight on this topic. It's an exciting time for Chevrat Nashim as they're working toward raising money to renovate the mikveh that we have here in Sharon. And I'm excited to be part of that whole endeavor. So last summer, there was a family in the Ein Kerem neighborhood in Jerusalem who decided they wanted to renovate their house. And, you know, they went through all the procedures, started to do the, took up their floors, to put on new floors, and they had to halt their project because they discovered underneath their house was an ancient mikveh. So apparently this is not uncommon in Israel. You're doing renovations, so you end up getting into all sorts of archaeological sites that you didn't think were underneath your house. And they actually got commended by like the Jewish Preservation Society in Israel for actually reporting it. I think other people might be like, probably didn't happen, so let's go ahead and build a house anyway. But they asked the archaeologists to come look at it. They discovered it was a mikveh dating back 2,000 years ago, which is a pretty important discovery because they always thought there was a Jewish community in this neighborhood of Ein Kerem, but they didn't have so much evidence. And this was really important evidence that there was a Jewish community going back in that neighborhood all the way to 2,000 years ago. Because if there's a mikveh, there's a Jewish community. And vice versa, if there's a Jewish community, there has to be a mikveh. The mikveh is one of the most important things in a Jewish community. In fact, it is halachically the first thing you're going to build in a community. If you have a choice between giving funds to buy a Torah, like a new Jewish, we're going to move to a new place. Which should we do first? Should we buy a Torah for a new community? Should we build a synagogue for a new community? Or should we build a mikveh? The mikveh comes first. Before you have anything else in the community, it's the most important thing. And throughout history, it's continued to be a very important part of our community. Now, they found on Masada, you know, when the Jews ran away from the Romans to Masada, they found on there two mikvahs, provided for women. You know, that even in really trying times, this was a mikveh that the Jewish community stood by and made sure to keep. Over the years, from, you know, biblical times till today, the exact function and build, thankfully, of the mikveh has changed slightly throughout the years, but it's continued to play an important part of our communities. And tonight, I'd like to discuss with you the history of the mikveh, both what is a mikveh, first of all, how it was used in biblical times, and how it is still used today. And additionally, what meaning did it have in biblical times and in our lives today? Any questions or comments before we get started?
I
forgot to point it out. That is, you can see, that's the floor on the top. The left is like when they picked up the floor that they found underneath it. And then the right is a picture of that mikveh they discovered.
So there was literally a door in there?
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Which is pretty cool to live in a place that had, you know, if any of you have been on archaeological sites in Israel, you're bound to come across mikvehs because they're all over the place. You know, there was part of, in biblical times, it was, they didn't all have private swimming pools, they all had, you know, mikvehs everywhere. So what exactly is a mikveh? It's not just a bathtub, it's not just a swimming pool, there's something special about it. So in a nutshell, a mikveh is used whenever in biblical times, if someone became tameh, which is like ritually impure. It's often translated as unclean, which I don't like the translation, although I know that some of the translations I brought does use that term. But the word teme is something we can't really relate to today, some sort of state of being ritually impure. We're going to go into who exactly fits that category. But anyone who came across severe situations that made them become in a state of tum'ah, of being teme, had to get out of that state, immersed in a mikvah. So what is this structure? So we learn about what a mikvah can consist of from a pasuk in Vayikra in Leviticus. That's source number one. So the pasuk in Hebrew reads, Ach ma'ayan uvor mikvah ma'im yetzahor. Okay, then the rest of it talks about how you can purify what became tameh through this thing. So the rabbis break down this pasuk word by word. So nevertheless, a spring or a cistern where there's collection, the word mikvah means collection, of water shall be pure. So let's go through this word by word to get at what exactly would constitute a mikvah. So it says, ah, right, the word nevertheless, or but, or only. We learned from that it can't be only this, meaning only what's described in this pasuk, and not a vessel, meaning not a bathtub, right, or something else. Anything that goes through like a man-made vessel. Ma'ayan is a spring, so the water has to be natural, or we call living waters, called Mayan Chaim, living waters. It can't be, tap water. It has to be some connected to nature. Then it says ubor, which means a pit. So learn from that the actual receptacle that this natural water goes into can be man-made. I mean, that's why our mikvahs today, it's not just a natural thing you can, they do exist, natural mikvahs, but it's something you can actually build. The actual pool, immersion pool, can be man-made. Then mikveh, right, that actually means the gathering of the waters, that the water can't be flowing. Okay, so the rule is that if the mikveh is collected from rainwater, it can't be flowing. Meaning that's why some rivers that are, let's say the river dries up and then it's filled by rainwater, that river would not be a kosher mikveh because it's flowing. If it's flowing, it can't be rainwater. It can be flowing if it's the source is a spring. Right, so that you have natural spring water that leads to a river, then that river would be a kosher mikvah. So the U.S. Nishmat has a hotline where women can call in with their questions. I'm traveling in India. I'm traveling wherever it is. There's a river here. There's no mikvah, obviously. There's a river. Can I use this mikvah, this river as a mikvah? You have to know how is the river getting its water? What season is it? Maybe in certain seasons it would be allowed, other seasons it wouldn't be allowed, depending on what's making out this river. Is it rainwater, streamwater, whatever it is? Mikvah mayim, it has to be water, okay, it can't be anything else besides water. Tahor, that everything, tahor is the opposite of tameh, it means pure, so everything that the water touches to get to it also has to be, all the receptacles, all the ducts also have to be made of materials that cannot become tameh. Any questions about what constitutes a mikvah? Okay, so oceans also do work. We say that even though that does work as a mikvah. And modern mikvahs today, you could use, again, like a natural spring or the ocean, certain lakes, depending on how they get their water from them. But today, we don't immerse in rainwater when we go into the mikvah because we actually care about cleanliness. And not, if you collect all that rainwater and then after more than one person used it over time, it would get quite dirty. So what they do instead, they build two mikvahs. They build two pools. So one of them collects the rainwater. That becomes like your natural mikvah, the water, like it might take a long time. And you can actually, you could fill, you know, sometimes snow would count if it like melted afterwards. But you fill that with rainwater and it comes directly from the roof. It has to be certain ducts, you know, in a way that it comes in from the roof through this basin. It can't go, it can't be drawn water. You can't bring your buckets and fill it in. It has to come by itself into the pool. Then you build another pool, which is actually the immersion pool, which people are actually going to go into. And that you can fill with tap water. You can clean it, whatever, however often you need to refill that water to make sure that it's clean. You can put some chlorine in it to make sure there's no, it stays clean. And then what you do is you have the natural mikvah. You make a little hole between the two of them, and they like, it's called like, they kiss each other. So like, the water from the natural rainwater mikvah, there's a little bit of a hole that touches the other mikvah, and that kind of infuses the tap water fills mikvah with the status of living waters of Mayim Chayim. That's what we do today. Other mikvah constructions have it like one's on top of the other, and then overflows a bit into the other one. There are different ways to construct it. But in any case, the mikvah that most women go into, or men go into today, is clean tap water that's changed, that's going to be infused with this natural Mayim Chayim. Yeah.
What if there's like no rain or snow for a long time and it gets like empty?
So I was just listening to a class about this, and he gave a case of a well-meaning janitor who was working for the synagogue of the mikvah. He came across this pool that was filled with yucky water, which was the rainwater mikvah, and he cleaned it out. So he drained it and he cleaned it out, but you know, and but this is like the summertime, and how are you supposed to wait for it to feel again? It took a long time. So given the circumstances in that community, the rabbis worked out that they could rely on an opinion that says ice can be, if you can move the ice to the mikvah, even though you're moving yourself, and then when it melts on itself, that's like it coming naturally into the water. So I think that's what they did. It's not ideal for a mikvah. Oftentimes, you can wait a long time.
Like ice from a freezer?
I don't know where they got it from, but maybe it's ice, but yeah, I think that's what it, I don't know what they relied on exactly. But I don't know, this is, you know, what I heard. I don't know the exact details of that. It's definitely not like that's what you usually do. I know that sometimes it could take a while for the pool to fill up with rainwater.
So I know that when we filled it in the past, it honestly doesn't take as much rain as we thought. Just a normal rain for about half an hour.
It depends where you live.
Here in the north, right.
Right now, if you're in Arizona, you know, no, it might take a long time for that to happen. But
I was very surprised. I thought it would be many rainfalls, hours of rainfall, something. Nah,
it's quick.
Like one rainfall and we were like overflowing.
Yeah, so we have it. It has to hold about 40 sena, which is about 91 gallons of water, to be a kosher mikvah. Right. Other questions? Okay. Okay, so now that we know a little bit more about what this mikvah actually is, what constitutes it, now let's go into who uses the mikvah. Okay, so who used it? Let's start with who used the mikvah in biblical times, go into modern times. So we spoke about the fact that someone uses the mikvah, someone who becomes tamei, who enters the state of tum'ah. What are some examples or people that you've heard of? As someone who becomes tameh, what kind of people become tameh? Anyone? Yeah.
Someone who touched something dead.
Okay, good. So that's in source 5. You want to read it for us? It's in bottom of the page.
He that touches the dead, even any man's dead body, shall be unclean 7 days. This is the law: when a man dies in the tent, even one that comes into the tent and everything that is in the tent shall be unclean 7 days.
Right, so if someone touches, as you mentioned, a dead body, or didn't touch the body, but is in the same overhanging as a person who has died, becomes tameh. Even today, like kohanim, who try, like the priests, and who try to avoid coming in contact contact with dead bodies, have to make sure not to be in a hospital. If there's someone in a hospital who has died, you know, even if they're same building as them without touching them, that also would cause the person to become Tamei. Anyone know other people who become Tamei?
If a man has released something, you usually have to, unless in a nice way,
yeah,
then you have to go as well.
Okay, good. That is source number two. Sorry, number three. Can I read that for us?
Which one? Sorry.
Number three. On the first page, so.
Oh, which one?
Source number three, yeah.
Okay. Speak unto the children of Israel and say unto them, when any man hath an issue out of his flesh, his issue is Tamei. And if a woman has an issue and her issue in her flesh is filthy blood, she shall be in her impurity 7 days, and whoever toucheth her shall be tamei until the evening.
Right, so any man or woman who has some sort of bodily emission also becomes tamei. That includes women having their regular menstrual cycle. That's kind of under the same category.
Childbirth,
okay, good. Number, source number four. Can you read that for us?
And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, saying, if a woman be delivered and bear a man child, then she shall be unclean 7 days, as in the times of the impurity of her sickness shall she be unclean.
Right, so when she gives birth, there's different laws for giving birth to a baby boy or baby girl. A baby girl, you are tamei for 14 days, for baby boy 7 days. We'll go into a little bit more about that a little bit later, hopefully. And other ones people know without cheating looking at the sheet?
I peeked.
Okay.
I might have known.
You can still say, yeah.
Saras.
Okay, good. Want to read that, the first source?
And the priest shall look upon the plague in the skin of the flesh, and if the hair in the plague be turned white, and the appearance of the plague be deeper than the skin of his flesh, it is the plague of leprosy, and the priest shall look on him and pronounce him tamei.
Right, so someone has called Saraat, some sort of like skin disease, for better translation, and not just, no, certain skin discolorations do not make a person tamei, and certain ones do. And that's why the Kohen, the priest, would evaluate, is this a kind of skin discoloration that does gender tuma or not? Is it so clear cut? This can also be on the person's house. And so it's kind of something that starts to exactly understand what this was. It's called Tzara'at. This person also becomes tamei. And without turning the page and peeking, anyone know anymore? Okay, so we can just turn the page then. The last one is, someone else wants to volunteer to read?
These are the ones that are unclean for you among all creeping creatures. Anyone who touches them when they are dead will be unclean until
they die. Good. So it lists like before this pasuk and after it. I kind of choose like a chosen one in the middle. Certain animals that when they're dead also gender tuma. Amongst them are bugs. So like kind of like any dead bug. Is that, you know, like if there's someone who like does, you know, tries to be tshuva and like is still sinning, you know, like so it's like someone who goes to the mikvah holding a bug. Meaning like you can't really become, you're not going to be pure from that because you're holding that bug, which automatically makes you impure, saying, I'll sin and then do tshuva, you're not actually doing real tshuva there. So and any sort of bug is gender's tuma. Okay, so kind of an interesting assortment of things, okay, that make that create the status of tumah in biblical times. So someone who does one of these various things becomes tamei, and they are prohibited from doing two things. I don't know what those two things are.
They can't give a korban, is that one? Otherwise, they can't have sexual relationships.
No.
Wrong.
The korban, right, they can't, well, that's probably, you know, they're not allowed to give a korban more than that. they can't even enter the Beitin HaMikdash. Okay, so not just to give a korban, but just even for anything, they can't enter the Beitin HaMikdash. And they also can't, like, touch holy things, eat holy foods. Kohen cannot eat truma, right, which is like the holy food of the kohanim. Those are the two things they can't do. They can't enter the Beit HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem, and they can't eat or touch holy things. Okay, so jumping to today, yeah. They can't, exactly. So if you remember the story, the Jews say, well, we missed our chance to eat the Korban Pesach because we were Tameh. You couldn't eat the Korban Pesach then. If we really miss it, it's not fair for us. And then, you know, through Moshe, they decide to say, okay, next month, the same time, you can do it. Make sure you'll be Tahor that time. You can have the Korban Pesach. What?
That's Pesach Sheni.
Exactly. That's Pesach Sheni. So kind of like for the people who kind of missed out the first time around. So today, we don't have the concepts of Tuma and Tahara. So if you touch a bug, it doesn't prohibit you from doing anything, you know, in our lives today. And we don't really, you know, people, we assume that because of the laws of someone who touched a dead body, they don't just go to the mikvah. There's a whole purification process that has to happen involving the red heifer, sprinkling the ashes on the person. And we don't do that today. So really, no one can be completely purified from touching a dead body. So therefore, we are all in this somewhat status of being tamei today. Because if you just touch a body and I touch you, or whatever it was, generations back, till the times we lost to the temple, we're all in that state of tumah today. These doesn't really matter to us that I can't enter the temple. There's no temple today anyway, right? So why don't you go to the temple today? But we still, again, the ritual of the mikvah still plays in our lives today in different ways. So who are some people who use the mikvah today? Do you know that?
Convert.
Okay, conversions. It's the last step in the conversion process. After learning and taking upon the mitzvot, doing a circumcision if you're male, the last step is immersing in a mikvah.
Right.
Good, okay, and grooms also. Brides and grooms before their weddings. The bride, there's different levels of what's necessary, what's commanded, and what's kind of more custom. But typically the bride and groom go to the mikvah before their weddings.
Wives.
Okay, so women, so after their monthly periods, continue going to the mikvah. So again, even though today there's no temple, there still exists a prohibition for husband and wife to be together after she has her period before going to the mikvah. So even though there's no temple, there's a third thing attached to the woman, who's the married woman. So that's why she continues going to the mikvah today, even though there's no, the other reasons don't exist anymore.
Men go.
What?
Men.
Men? Okay, when would men go? Okay, so some go, it's a very widespread custom to go before Rosh Hashanah, before Yom Kippur. Some go every Erev Shabbos, and same with more like other different parts of Judaism. Some men go every morning. In some classical circles, they go every morning as well. What else are you using the cook for?
Dishes.
Good, okay. I remember when I moved in with my friend into our apartment in Washington Heights, and we had to tovel, right, to put all our dishes in the mikvah. So we, you know, piled a bunch of pots and pans and stuff in a suitcase, and we were bringing it down to the mikvah by the Breuer Shul. And our super, you know, stops us, very friendly guy. Hey girls, where are you guys going? You know, so we thought about it. Should we tell them we're going to dip our dishes into a ritual bath? Like, I think we just like told them we're like going for a walk or something. But you know, it is kind of an interesting thing that we do, put our dishes into the mikvah. But that is, again, something that still remains today. Okay, so these are kind of the main ways that mikvah plays in our lives today. So as you can see, even though the exact use of the mikvah has changed from biblical times till today, it still remains a central part of being involved in very important events and relationships in our community as being very central. So how has it been passed down through generations? I mentioned it's always been very important, but it hasn't always been treated with the same importance that it deserves. So in an anthology about the mikvah called Total Immersion, edited by Rivka Slonin, there's an article, like an anthology of different articles. One article is by Joshua Hoffman. He writes about the history of the mikvah in America. And he says that in the early times with the immigrants to America, the first ones did use the mikvah, the first ones. But after that, the next generation kind of dropped it off and stopped using the mikvah. He gives three main reasons for why the mikvah stopped being used. Can anyone guess what those were in the early 1900s? What? Okay, well, the original people did build them, but maybe people moved, let's say, like in the 1920s or 30s out to the boondocks. Maybe they didn't have them in all of the communities.
They wanted to fit in?
Yeah, the ritual seemed outdated a bit, right? Like it was something that their non-Jewish counterparts were not doing, especially the Reformed Jews who came. We're trying to rationalize Judaism. They got rid of a lot of the mitzvot, commandments, that didn't make sense to them logically. Now they've taken all of them back, but originally mikvah was one of those things that got dropped because it didn't really make sense. Like, we have bathtubs in our own houses. I don't need to go to a ritual bath to feel like I'm, whatever that meant. Like, it's some sort of tumah that we can't really tap into and understand today. Okay, good. Other ideas?
It got a bad name. Like, people said it wasn't clean.
Yes, exactly. They weren't, in fact, they weren't so clean. They do have record of some of them actually being like shut down because they were not clean, right? So luckily, we weren't living in those days. And also, people weren't educated, right? So they thought that if you think it's all about being clean, meaning if the mikvah is supposed to be about, oh, like you think I'm dirty, right? Let's say a woman has, after having a period, I'm dirty, and that's why I have to use the mikvah. Well, nowadays I have my own private bathtub, or my own private in my bath, in my room. I can get cleaned that way, right? So if you don't know that the mikvah is not about physical dirt in any way, but something more spiritual, if you're not educated in that way, you can kind of say you don't really need it anymore, and say it's not necessary. Additional reasons that he found were that they didn't want to mark something so private in a public space. They were kind of wanted more privacy there. And to counteract some of these challenges, there's a rabbi by the name of Rabbi David Miller, I'm not sure they're related to you anyway, who actually was trying to increase the usage of mikvah in America, and he advocated, first of all, he had a different halachic interpretation of what constitutes okay water for the mikvah, and his understanding was based on a minor opinion that you can use tap water for the mikvah. We don't follow that opinion today, but there is an opinion that exists that tap water would be allowed. So he advocated was to build private mikvahs in your own home. There's a picture of it. If you look at source number 7, okay, so he says, it's like a, so the drawing above, or it was above, represents a simply constructed mikvah, as in plan 3, he gives different kinds of plans, having a fitted top. Covers and drapes may be used on the outside, giving it an ornamental finish. It may be made to appear as a dressing table, or a folding bed, maybe disguised as a wardrobe, a cedar chest, or a cabinet, right? So his idea was to kind of make a chest, like a standing wooden box in your house, fill it with the city's water, and then disguise it somehow So everyone would have their own private mikvah in their house that they can kind of keep clean to their own liking. And it's not the halachic opinion that we follow, that would be allowed. But it was kind of interesting to see the lengths you went. You made a whole pamphlet of different kinds of different ways you could do it to try to get people, more people to use the mikvah during that time in American history. So when the immigrants came to the U.S. after World War II, from Europe, who were using the mikvah in Europe, they came to America and they were like, what's going on here? Like, where are the mikvahs, right? So they built more mikvahs, and the newer immigrants after World War II were mikvah users, and they revitalized mikvah a bit. And it really took off in the 60s with the Baal Teshuva movement, where a lot of people came back to Judaism in that time. And really, that's when the rebirth of the mikvah began. And today, mikvah has seen a real renewal of real people finding more interest in this mitzvah and kind of taking it back and saying that this is something that we want to embrace, not just the very pious Jews, not just Orthodox Jews, and but Jews who are consider themselves more secular are also coming back to mikvah as a really powerful ritual. If you look at source number 8, this is an article taken from the Jerusalem Report about 15 years ago. Someone read that for us? Go for it.
But Rachel Sabbath, a Reform rabbi who has written extensively on mikveh use, says that it is changing. I think we are on the other side of blood being seen as taboo. Sabbath, who goes to the Mikveh Monthly, says, rather than that, it's seen as an affirmation of health and life, and women are seeing their monthly cycles as not only being connected to issues of reproduction, but to their own experience of their bodies. Going to the mikveh, as she sees it, is a way of marking what the body is doing. Some women believe that the reformers may have thrown out too much with the mikveh water. Shuli Rubin Schwartz, a professor of American Jewish history at the Conservative Jewish Theological Seminary, sees the return to mikveh as part of a second wave of Jewish feminism. The first wave, Schwartz says, was a search for equality and egalitarianism. The second wave, which started in the 1980s and which has been marked by such things as the growth of women's monthly Rosh Chodesh groups, is about reconnecting with traditions that are unique to Jewish women. Now it's about, okay, I've got equality, now what can I reclaim of being a Jewish woman? Maybe we've lost too much, Wolf says. Let's examine it and reinterpret it.
And this is what I think we're seeing a lot of people of all walks of stripes and being Jewish coming back to it and trying to reinterpret how they see mikvah in their lives, bringing it back in their lives. So what interpretation are people giving it? What is the meaning of this ritual? What can we find? What is so inspiring about it to people? So the last part of our class, we're going to talk about some meanings behind this mitzvah, the ritual of the mikvah. So before we go into giving a reason or to it, I want to clearly state that we don't really know the reason that we have the mikvah. If you look at source number 9, the Midrash says, the dead body does not defile, the water does not cleanse. Rather, God said, I've issued an order and made a decree, and no man may violate my decree. Meaning, like, this is considered, it's called a chok, a category of mitzvot. We do not know the reason for it. So when it comes to chukim, the mitzvot we don't know the reasons for, let's say, not eating meat and milk together, right? Like, why can't we do that? There's no logical reason for it, okay? We just can't, okay? So when it comes to those kinds of things, I very much admire the opinion of Rav Soloveitchik, who says that we may not be able to ask the question of why, meaning why can't we eat and milk together, why can't we mix wool and linen together and thread it to make a garment? We don't know the answer to those questions. He also can't ask the question of how, meaning a book about the red heifer and sprinkling the... How exactly does the ash sprinkled from the red heifer make somebody pure? We can't answer those kinds of questions. The question we can ask is what? Meaning, what meaning can I find in this mitzvah? You know, it might not be the same meaning you find in it, but we can all find our own meaning in these mitzvahs. So that's saying this is the meaning, God's meaning. Maybe there is no meaning, maybe there is, but we don't really know. We can't ask that question. We can ask, what do I get out of this mitzvah? So I want to share with you two approaches to the meaning that you can get out of the mitzvah of the mikvah. So the first one, we're going to look at the Rambam. So in the Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, Maimonides does try to give you reasons for the mitzvot. He divides the 613 mitzvot commandments into different categories, and he speaks about different categories of these mitzvot, what they are there for. So in chapters 35, he begins to describe, he lays out, this whole category of mitzvot, talks about Tum'ah and Tahara, and he says, the general object of these laws is, as well will be explained by me, to discourage people from frequently entering the sanctuary, in order that their minds be impressed with the greatness of the sanctuary and approach it with respect and reverence. Okay, so he says, for this reason, the unclean, right, meaning the Tum'ah, were not allowed to enter the sanctuary, although there are so many kinds of uncleanliness that at a time, only a few people are actually tahor, clean. For even if a person does not touch a beast that died of his own accord, he can scarcely avoid touching one of the eight kinds of creeping animals, like the bugs, the dead bodies of which we find at all times in houses, in food and drink, hopefully not, and upon which we frequently tread wherever we walk. Although we did find our first tick on my son. This is about living and sharing, right? All this serves to keep people away from the sanctuary and to prevent them from entering it whenever they like. By such acts, the reverence for the sanctuary will continue. The right impression will be produced, which leads man, as intended, to humility. What he's saying here, he's saying that the idea is that Hashem does not want us to have unlimited, frequent access to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple. So we're going to limit that access by saying people who engage or come across any one of these natural occurring things has to be in a period where they cannot enter the Mikdash, the temple. And again, these things are not bad. They're just, why were they chosen according to the Rambam? Why are these things what makes them untamei?
They were blind, they showing us the archaeological excavations of mikvahs next to
the Har HaBayit,
they uncovered those.
Yeah, that's cool because that, you know, they kind of went there right away, you know, so you wouldn't walk on a bug, right, after you go into the mikvah and then have to go again.
So they had them right there, the people.
Yeah, which is great, right? The whole idea is that we, these are all things that are natural. They happen every day. They're common occurrences, right? The monthly period, yeah, it happens to women. That's a fact, right? It's not a bad thing. It's just a fact of life. There's bugs. That's a fact of life. People die. It's a fact of life, right? All these things are natural things which we're bound to come across in our daily lives, which means that at any given moment, there's bound to be lots of people who are in a state of Tum'ah, being Tameh. They can't enter the Beit HaMikdash, right? And the point of that is that we maintain the reverence we have for it. You know, I remember the first time I went to the Kotel when I was 12 years old. And now, like, you hear about it, you're so excited to go, and you have that, like, feeling of awe, right, of being at the Kotel. I lived in Israel for 3 years of my life. I guess I didn't have that same feeling each time I went back to the Kotel. Have any of you been there and seen people on their cell phones, like, right up front, right? It's like, those are all the Yerushalmites, people who live in Yerushalayim, right, who go there every day, all the time, and they're used to it. They didn't do it the first time they went to the Kotel, but, you know, so on the one hand, Jeff, you're like, what are you doing? And the other hand's like, they're comfortable, right? In the sense that this is their home, and they're here a lot. And the more comfortable you are walking in somewhere, whenever you like, the less reverence you have for it. So by creating the system of Tum'ah, it keeps people away, thereby helping us maintain this reverence and humility. Right? Raman says it all leads back to humility that we have for our place via the Almighty. So while this exact meeting might be hard for us to relate to, we don't have the same law preventing us. You can go to the kotel when you are tamei. You're allowed to do that. I think the idea of setting limits for our lives is very relatable and very necessary for us. That, especially in today's age, where we're like addicted to our cell phones and technology, there's a need for limits of that. You know, an article I read a few months ago was talking about how the title was "Our Gadget-Free Bedrooms: A Secret to a Happy Relationship," right? Meaning they said that if one partner is on their device in front of the other partner who is trying to communicate with them, that leads to a very bad relationship, right? That kind of has increased the distancing of two people from each other. But when one person is in there and their cell phone, tablet, whatever it is, in front of the other person, right? And they talk about making bedrooms like gadget-free zones. So that's one area, okay, where I think limits are necessary to build relationships. And in other areas of our lives, we limit what we can eat. We don't eat certain foods. We don't eat certain foods together. We don't eat certain foods after other foods. And all those limits serve to sanctify how we eat, right? Eating is something all animals do, and that becomes a holy act by setting those limits and boundaries. And similarly, in marriages, where when a woman is has not gone to mikvah yet after a period, she is still not allowed to be with her husband, those limits sanctify the whole act of a husband and wife relationship. You know, having those limits in our lives help us elevate and sanctify that whole physical part of the relationship. So that's one meaning you can find in mikvah, the idea of formation around them, mikvah reminds us to have limits in our lives. Second idea is we're going to look at by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan in his book, Waters of Eden, where he talks about the beauty and the meaning behind the mikvah. And he writes, here, look at the first few lines. Things that cause ritual defilements are primarily associated with death, as you mentioned, the first one. So other causes of uncleanness are things associated with man's imperfection. So death and imperfection, as said Sarah. So if you think about all of them, right, dead bodies, obviously death, dead animals, obviously death. Sarat, right, is like death of skin cells on your hands. A woman who menstruates, so that is the loss of potential life there. What about a woman who gives birth? That's probably like the one that's hard to fit into this category. Anyone have an idea of how Yolet would fit into death? Yolet is someone who gives birth.
In your death.
What?
A near-death experience.
Okay, so especially for women before there was modern medicine, a lot of women did die in childbirth. So perhaps they kind of feared their death. Okay, that's interesting.
I mean, there's a lot of blood loss following the baby.
Okay.
I think blood is associated with death.
Okay, so a lot, yeah. You mean
the birth of the placenta.
Right. So there is an opinion that the placenta like kind of dies there. Other ideas are that the woman, even though life was given to the world, the woman herself lost that life within her. And they say this is one reason why some say when a woman gives birth to a baby girl, she is doubly tamei. She is tamei for 2 weeks instead of 1 week. It's very unusual. Most people are tamei for 1 week because she not only loses that life inside of her, but also the potential that baby girl also has life inside of her, that she loses kind of both of those from her body. And there's another side to this idea of the woman gives birth from Rabbi Sachs, the chief rabbi, Lord Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, who says in source 12 here that Tum'ah should therefore not be thought of a defilement as if it were something wrong or sinful. Tumah is about mortality. So death bespeaks mortality, but so too does birth. Not necessarily death, it's being coming to terms with the fact that we're mortal, right? We're dying, but we also are born, right? God is not is not born. He's eternal, whereas we mortal people, they die and they're born. So he goes on to say, a skin disease like psoriasis makes us vividly aware of the body. Right? We're aware that when some sort of ailment is on our skin, that we are frail mortal beings, right? That we can't, are not in control of our health. So does an unusual physical attribute, like the shape of men, this is the one, even mold on a garment or the wall of a house, right? Symptom of physical decay. There's nothing wrong about any of these things, but they focus our attention on the physical and are therefore incompatible with the holy space of the tabernacle, of the temple, dedicated to the presence of the non-physical, eternal, infinite, and never dies or decays. Tuma does not mean defilement, and means that which distracts from eternity and infinity by making us forcibly aware of mortality, of the fact that we are physical beings in a physical world. Right, so all of these things remind us that we are mortal, physical beings. And when we have that mindset, we can't enter the Beit HaMikdash, a place of the eternal, the infinite, the non-physical being at all. We have to, once we have encountered some sort of recognition of our own mortality, death or birth or some other way of reminding us that we're mortal beings, we have to immerse in a mikvah. So why a mikvah? So if you go back to Rabbi Kaplan, he says, seen in this light, we see that the mikvah represents the womb. Okay? When an individual enters a mikvah, he is re-entering the womb. Here I am, second line on Rabbi Kaplan. When he emerges, he is as if born anew. Thus he attains a completely new status. Right? So the mikvah, if tum'ah, these ideas are related to death, to being related to our mortality, the mikvah as a womb where you are totally surrounded by water, you can't just like dip your arm and your leg, you have to actually be totally, completely surrounded by the water all at one time, like a baby is in a womb. And that kind of rejuvenates us as a new creature, someone born anew, totally afresh, without this association with death. He says so, right? Not just any womb, right? He says, in a sense, therefore, the water represents the womb of creation, okay? Like the title of his book is Waters of Eden, right? He traces the waters, the Mayim Chayim, the living waters of the mikvah, all the way back to the waters of creation. When a person immerses in the mikvah, he's placing himself in a state of the world yet unborn, subjecting himself totally to God's creative power, right? It talks about, we just read in this creation story, the waters, the rivers that are flowing through the Garden of Eden, the four rivers. So it says, some way the mikvah is supposed to tap into those rivers of creation, because the waters, they can't just be tap water, it has to be somewhere natural waters to tap into that whole creation narrative. Because as we go into the mikvah, we are, again, tapping into being created totally anew. And he goes on to say, in order to renew ourselves, we have to humble ourselves. This is the Rambam spoke about humility as the root here. So he says, Mayim shares the same root as the word ma, which means what, right? Mayim, ma. When a person immerses in water, he's nullifying his ego and asking, what am I? Ego is the essence of permanence, while water is the essence of impermanence. When a person is ready to replace his ego with a question, then he's ready to be reborn with his answer. Right? When we can humble ourselves enough to say we're not all in charge, we need to be kind of reborn again. We have that humility. We are able to come out of the mikvah. There's a Hasidic idea that says that immersion, tefillah, is similar to the word, and if you rearrange the language, bitul, which means nullification, right? So you have to nullify yourself, and then you can, when you go into the mikvah, you get rid of your own ego, of, I think I run the world, right? I think I'm so great. You go into this water, and you're born totally more humble in front of God. And it's a beautiful idea for in the process of conversion, right, to have that idea of being really reborn anew and immersing as a new person. So, and I know that this idea today, you don't have the mikvah today, but I think this idea of renewal and rebirth can still be tapped into in the mikvah process. So I know that the average person doesn't think of their menstrual period as a death, as I encounter death. But women who are trying to conceive are more aware of the fact that this month did not result in a new life, resulted in the lost opportunity for life. And especially after a miscarriage, where a woman will also use the mikvah at that point, you know, can feel the sense of loss. And even if it was very early on, there's still a sense of loss and a sense of miss life there, especially women undergoing fertility treatments, right, where after a very long process, and then there's a sense of loss at the end, it could be a really painful experience, like death. And I think that there's not a coincidence that the word mikvah is also similar to the word tikva, which means hope, right? Because I think for a lot of women, the mikvah ritual is very meaningful, like to say, okay, this month there was an encounter with death, but I'm going to re-enter the mikvah, be reborn, start anew, start afresh, have more hope going forward for the future, that there will be more life and there will be more creation going forward. So I know the hour is running a little bit late, so I'll just conclude here that by saying that, you know, we've discussed mikvah and its role in the Jewish community as one of the central important rituals that we've had from biblical times all the way to modern times. So while the exact details of who used the mikvah, exactly how the mikvah was structured, has changed over the years, but it's kind of its role in our lives and perhaps the meaning we can tap into it has remained with us. So as we discussed the water and the rejuvenating power that water has, I want to share with you a statement in Chazal found in Baba Kama 17a, which says, "Ein mayim ela Torah," meaning there's no water, Torah. When a text talks about mayim, it refers to Torah. So similarly, I think if water refers to Torah, then Torah can be water, and I hope that the Torah learning that you learn tonight can be just as rejuvenating and refreshing and giving us a lot of renewed energy, just as water can. Thank you so much. Happy to take questions.
Thank you.
Go ahead.